Centuries earlier, or so the Bible account goes, God dictated to Moses the exact blueprint for his desert's temple, the tabernacle. It mattered that the ornate tent was made from the finest materials by the best craftspeople. That way, people knew that God had the highest expectations from his people. When Solomon built a temple from stone in Jerusalem, he placed the worship of God front and central in his kingdom. Yet, within 200 years, the vibe has slipped so far that Judah's king values the temple more for its aesthetics than for any sacredness, adding interior design embellishments that have nothing to do with worshipping God. My name is Chaz Bayfield, and this is Holy Bible, Episode 89, The Leper King. Hello again, Bible fans, or maybe you're not a Bible fan. Maybe you just hit latest episode to see if I'm about to disprove the book or rabidly avow that every letter of it is true. I'll be doing neither. Holy Bible is simply a gentle stroll through the entire Bible, telling listeners the general gist of the story while adding a bit of commentary and a few fun facts. It's about as unreligious as a Bible podcast can be. Full disclosure, I love the Bible, especially how it has influenced so much of Western culture. Any Mary, Maria, John, Johann, Jim, James, or Giovanni owes their name to this book. Love it or hate it, buy into it or disagree with every word, the Bible still matters, which is why I'm doing this podcast. Right, formalities over, let's head back to the ancient Near East, circa 840 BC. Amaziah takes over the throne of Judah from his father Joash as a young man in the prime of life. He's 25 at the time he becomes king and goes on to reign for 29 years, following much the same godly path as Joash before him. The writer points out that Amaziah is still no David, which seems a little unfair given the high bar set by Israel's second king. Amaziah may not clear away the nation's pagan shrines, but he does avenge his father's death, killing the assassins responsible. Jewish law forbids the punishment of children for the crimes of their parents, and so Amaziah allows the men's children to live. He also defeats a 10,000-strong army from the neighbouring country of Edom, capturing the Edomite city of Sela in the process. He may score highly on godliness, but Amaziah proves to be somewhat of a liability for Judah, throwing down a challenge to Israel's king Jehoash to fight him. Jehoash tells him not to be so arrogant and that defeating Edom is nothing to boast about. A bit of a storyteller, Jehoash describes a thistle asking a cedar for his daughter in marriage before being crushed under the foot of a wild animal and warns Judah's king to stay safe and stay home. This is fighting talk to Amaziah, who refuses to back down, and Jehoash is left with no choice than to fight. The armies meet at a place called Beth Shemesh in western Judah, and the battle is a huge embarrassment to Judah. Amaziah is captured, and an almost 600-foot breach is smashed into Jerusalem's city walls. That's 180 metres if you're not in America or the UK. Incidentally, this is the only case of a king of Judah being captured by Israel, and it is possible that Amaziah remains a hostage in Samaria until the death of Jehoash. Jehoash's victorious troops then ransack Jerusalem's temple and royal palace before running back to their own capital city of Samaria, laden down with treasure and hostages. After this military high point, Jehoash exits the Bible and is replaced by his son Jeroboam II. Amaziah outlives his rival in Israel to the north by 15 years, but his cards are clearly marked. His unpopularity among his own people means that he has to escape to the city of Lachish, but a death squad tracks him down and puts an end to his reign. Amaziah's corpse is brought back for burial in Jerusalem, where he is succeeded by his 16-year-old son, the almost identical-sounding Azariah. This king also goes by the name Uzziah, and later rebuilds the important trading city of Elath on the Gulf of Aqaba. Israel's king appears equally as pagan as his golden calf-worshipping namesake. Just as Judah's godly kings are measured against David, Israel's godless rulers are all compared to the original monarch responsible for breaking up the 12 tribes and splitting Israel into two nations, Israel and Judah. A king named Jeroboam. Reigning over the northern kingdom for an astonishing 41 years, Jeroboam II is the nation's longest-serving monarch. Though he allows idol worship to thrive in his country, Jeroboam's reign is hugely successful for Israel politically. He manages to claw back an enormous amount of lost land, including the strategically important city of Damascus. If added to Judah, the territory rivals the extent of the kingdom in the days of Solomon. The writer puts Jeroboam's land grab down to God's loyalty to his people, who have suffered considerable oppression from enemy nations. As God promised not to blot out Israel, the Bible believes that he uses Jeroboam to liberate his people. His deeds immortalized in the no longer extant annals of the kings, Jeroboam dies, handing over the baton to his son Zechariah. Down in Judah, the royal bloodline continues with Amaziah's teenage son Azariah, who, like his father, loves God and follows his laws. It's easy to get confused with these kings, all of whose names appear to begin with either the letter J or A, many of whom sound almost identical. But, like Amaziah, Azariah also fails to remove the pagan shrines in Judah, and he too appears to be at odds with his idol-worshipping subjects. According to the book, Azariah achieves nothing more in his 52-year reign than contracting leprosy. However, in the second book of Chronicles later on in the Old Testament, a book which views Judah's kings as almost universally saintly, Azariah is called Uzziah and is a warrior king who defeats the Philistines, fortifies Jerusalem and equips its army. In that book, it is the king's pride that is his downfall. He enters the temple and tries to burn incense, and the leprosy is punishment for attempting to carry out the duty that is exclusive to the role of a priest, without actually being one. Thanks to his skin disease, Azariah spends his final years living in a separate house to his family, while ruling responsibilities are handed over to his son, and yes, you're right, his name begins with a J, Jotham. After over four decades with just one king, Israel has three new kings in a single year. Jeroboam II proves to be a powerful influence on his son, and Zechariah follows the same pagan practices as his father. He is the fourth king to rule who is descended from Jehu, and readers who have made it this far into the second book of Kings know that Jehu was promised four generations of heirs by God. A staggering period of calm, given how frequently the nation's previous monarchs were bumped off. Now this promise has been fulfilled, the suggestion is that God's divine protection has been removed, and it's open season. Sure enough, just 6 months into Zechariah's reign, a rival by the name of Shallum assassinates him publicly, then seizes the crown for himself. Shallum himself only reigns for a month. A rebel called Menahem from Jeroboam I's original state capital Tirzah rides into town with visions of grandeur. Menahem's coup is a success, and he becomes Israel's third king in just over 6 months. Menahem is no fan of God nor his religious code, and proves to be Israel's most violent ruler. When he heads out of Samaria to ensure that the rest of the country falls in behind him, the inhabitants of a city called Tifsha refuse to open their city gates to him. Punishment is brutal. Menahem attacks the city, destroying it and ripping open the bellies of all its pregnant women, an act of violence that only the Assyrians get close to in ancient Near Eastern history. This appallingly brutal tribe might have been Menahem's inspiration. The Assyrians later invade Israel, and in order to get rid of them, Menahem has to pay Assyria's king, Tiglath-Pileser III, a staggering 34 tons of silver. Rather than foot the bill himself, he imposes a tax on the nation's wealthier inhabitants. He must each, inverted commas, donate just over £1 in weight of silver. That's around 550 grams of their own precious metal to Assyria's king. The appeal is a success, and Tiglath-Pileser withdraws, but this first appearance of Assyria in the pages of the Bible is by no means its last, and no amount of money can prevent the aggressive rise of the region's first superpower. Archaeologists have discovered evidence of great destruction to Israelite cities at the time of Tiglath-Pileser III's invasion, and naturally, Bible fans find this hugely exciting. With many non-believers crowing that the Bible is all fairy tale and myth, historical evidence that tallies with the Bible record suggests that at the very least, some Bible accounts are, in fact, true. It's probably worth taking a short detour to learn a little more about the Assyrians as they play such a huge role in the next 200 years of Bible history. At the time that Menahem is ruling Israel, the Near East is dominated by an empire whose territory today is covered by Syria, Iraq, Jordan, and Lebanon. This ancient warlike nation claims to be descended from Ashur, a grandson of Noah, and is centered around the River Tigris, from which it expands to conquer much of the region west towards the Mediterranean. Remarkably resistant, Assyria keeps its mojo for 13 centuries, and during the time covered in the Second Book of Kings, it seems overly keen to add Israel to its list of conquered countries. The archetype of the typical Assyrian is one of almost unspeakable cruelty, particularly towards anyone captured in battle. Skinning and skewering are commonplace. The Assyrians think nothing of impaling corpses on stakes or piling severed heads in heaps, and the fear of their barbaric, powerful and well-armed soldiers and sophisticated weaponry among their Near Eastern neighbours is immense. The Assyrians speak Aramaic, and for all their brutality, they are also gifted scientists and engineers. Interestingly, they are credited with the invention of antidepressants, the courier system, libraries and stone dams. But it is their mastery of iron weapons that makes them such fearsome opponents and such a seemingly undefeatable superpower. After 10 years on Israel's throne, Menahem dies, or, as the book likes to put it when a king is buried, he rests with his ancestors. His son, Pekahiah, takes the wheel. He is seen by the Second Book of Kings as yet another bad egg who fails to realise that honouring God should be second nature to a king of Israel. After he has reigned just 2 years, one of Pekahiah's senior ministers stages a coup. Raising a cohort of 50 soldiers from east of the river, Pekah assassinates the king in a fortified area of Samaria's royal palace. Two other men, Argob and Ariah, are also killed by Pekah. It's not certain if these were close advisers of Pekahiah who might oppose the new king, or co-conspirators who may want the throne for themselves. He may be skilled at killing kings, but Pekah falls woefully short of being able to manage a country or coordinate its spiritual life according to the rules given to Saul and David. He fails to follow God or suppress pagan religions, and during his 20-year reign, Tiglath-Pileser marches into northern Israel. Assyria's king seizes 6 cities before overrunning the whole of Galilee, Gilead, and the tribal land of Naphtali, deporting the people to his own country. Just as he took the throne in an act of violence, so Pekah loses it. He is attacked and killed by a man named Hoshea, who announces himself Israel's king in his place. The age of Samuel anointing Saul and then David is several lifetimes ago, and the latter kings of Israel appear to be violent, power-hungry thugs who couldn't care less of what God thinks. They run what the Bible sees as God's country while allowing his chosen people to drift ever further away from the religious codes which earlier books suggest he taught them. Aside from Elijah and Elisha and a number of other holy men, the books of Kings make no reference to any other prophets begging their nation's agnostic monarchs to turn back to God in order to safeguard the future of Israel. At least 9 prophets whose books appear later in the Bible operate during this time, though only Isaiah is mentioned. Still, all their warnings are in vain, and with the first attacks from Assyria occurring during his time as king, Pekah's reign marks the beginning of the end for the northern kingdom. While things are falling apart in Israel, Judah thrives under a brace of monarchs who follow God rather than his local rivals. In stark contrast to the monarchy in Israel, Amaziah of Judah's son Jotham is seen by the Bible as a good king. He may not rid his country of its pagan shrines, but readers are told that God approves of his rule and credits him with making repairs to the temple, just like his grandfather Joash. Jotham rules at the same time that Pekah is in charge of Israel and Rezin rules Aram, having taken over from Ben-Hadad. Both these kings attack Judah, which the book tells its readers is an act of God, without explaining why he would do this, given that, up until now, the country has enjoyed a succession of sober and upright kings. Now that Tiglath-Pileser is cleaning up in the Near East and is beginning to amass an empire, Judah needs a ruler of similar calibre. Assyria's king is an astute politician and a great leader. He takes advantage of military weakness within his own kingdom to seize power, conquering neighbouring territories and demanding valuable contributions from them, which help enrich Assyria's coffers. Meanwhile, Judah must make do with whatever descendant of David happens to have a crown popped on his head when his father dies, which, in this case, is Ahaz. If honouring God and his laws is a benchmark, Ahaz is an appalling king. Instead of keeping true to God, he worships at pagan altars and even goes so far as to sacrifice his own children on these altars. Thumbing his nose at God doesn't appear to have any immediate consequences. A joint siege against his capital city Jerusalem by a coalition army from Pekah's Israel and Rezin's Aram fails. While Ahaz may assume that it was fear of him that drove the two armies away, Rezin clearly has some fight left in him. Possibly not wanting to return home without some kind of military success, he attacks the seaport of Elath, modern-day Eilat, driving out everyone from Judah who has settled there. The place then fills with people from neighbouring Edom, suggesting that Rezin didn't even want it and just needed to save face after failing in Jerusalem. Even so, Ahaz is spooked and, possibly fearing that the two kings will return with reinforcements, runs to Assyria's Tiglath-Pileser with pockets full of gold. He empties the temple and palace treasuries to win Tiglath-Pileser's support, and his efforts pay off. Assyria's king attacks Aram's capital, Damascus, deports its people, and kills Rezin. Ahaz then makes a state visit to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser and is so impressed with a pagan altar he sees there that he sends detailed sketches and construction plans back to Judah's high priest, Uriah. Incredibly, the king has Jerusalem's temple altar remodeled as if it were an architectural fashion statement rather than a place of worship. Seemingly prepared to take spiritual advice from his king, rather than double-check with any of Judah's other holy men, or even God, Uriah has the altar built by the time Ahaz returns from his trip. The king offers sacrifices on his new showpiece, pushing Solomon's original to one side. All sacrifices are now to be made on this altar, and, showing an impressive lack of self-awareness, Ahaz reserves the original bronze altar for himself in the belief that he might use it as his own personal direct line to God, who he hopes will respond with advice. Several other of the temple furnishings are also seen as too last season by Judah's king. He removes the bulls that support the sea, the giant bowl used for ritual washing, and replaces them with stone ones like he has seen in Assyria. He also jettisons other bronze fixtures that have been in place for hundreds of years, as well as a canopy whose removal he feels might impress his new Assyrian best friend. In fairness to Ahaz, historians believe that part of his reason for removing the bronze fixtures from the temple was to pay Tiglath-Pileser for his protection. The prophet Isaiah has the challenge of being a spokesperson for God at the same time as Ahaz is king, and begs him to put his faith in God rather than political alliances. Isaiah is the first prophet to be mentioned in the Old Testament, whose book also appears in the Bible, but his words fall on deaf ears. By the time that Ahaz is bundled into his grave in around 716 BC, the kingdom of Judah is considerably smaller than when he first became king. From the point of view of those flying the flag of Jewish faith, Judah finally receives the monarch it needs. Ahaz's son Hezekiah appears more focused on pleasing God than fussing over the textures, lighting, and design features of his temple. There's only so long that Judah's northern neighbour Israel can hold out against the Assyrian threat, and the Bible puts the country's eventual annihilation down to its almost complete abandonment of God. Israel was once a proud nation, established by 12 tribes who believed that they had reached the land of milk and honey. Their ancient stories tell them of how Moses, then Joshua, led them from slavery in the brickyards of northern Egypt to successful colonization of Canaan, with God swinging every battle in their favor. Some 7 centuries later, the dream is over. Israel's last king is a two-faced assassin, woefully ill-equipped to prevent his once glorious country's utter destruction by the Assyrian military machine. The northern kingdom is about to fall. Holy Bible is written and produced by me, Chas Bayfield, with music by Michael Old and John Hawkins Music. Cover art is by Lisa Goff. If you'd like to send any comments or feedback, send them to contact@holybible.com, or you can post on our Twitter feed or our X feed, you choose, Holy Bible Podcast. You can also read the first 50 or so episodes as a downloadable book. Just go to Amazon and search Snakes and Angels, A Secular Walk Through the First 5 Books of the Bible. Thanks for listening. See you next time.